Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are recording from the west coast of Sweden in Scandinavia. You can find us worldwide on the internet. Each Thursday and Sunday we have a new radio program available on our website redicecreations.com. And today we're going to explore an interesting subject. We're going to talk about the evidence that we may be living in a programmed reality. Many of the Earthlings are, of course, programmed by school, religion and media, or the lack of media. But what we're going to talk about today is another kind of programming. And this is about the idea that we actually might be living in the Matrix, to draw a modern parallel. We have author Jim Elwidge with us on the line, and we are going to talk about his book, The Universe Solved. The website is theuniversesolved.com, where you can find some nice visuals, articles, and other food for thought about this concept that we'll be discussing today. So do take a look, theuniversesolved.com. Jim, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Welcome, and thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Henrik. It is a pleasure to be on the program, and I'm looking forward to it.
Definitely. It's great to have you here. It's going to be very interesting to talk about your theory, one that I've been fascinated by myself for quite some time, especially, of course, after I saw the first of the Matrix movies that really kind of nailed the concept on actually many different levels for me. But Jim, if you will, tell us a little bit about your background in regards to this field and also how you came to develop, I guess, your thesis or theory. How did it start, so to speak?
Sure, absolutely. Actually, the book and the research and the concepts in the book have pretty much nothing to do with what I do for a day job, and I suppose that's probably the case for a lot of people who research things like this. I'm an engineer by education. I've been in the computer and technology world for all of my career, and but at the same time, you know, I have had some sort of entrepreneurial ventures and some interesting positions over the years. But at the same time, I've always been fascinated with some other things. For example, in when I went to university, I studied a lot of physics. Although I didn't go into that field, I was always fascinated with both the very large and the very small, cosmology, quantum mechanics, those kinds of things. So I spent a lot of time researching those, and even in my spare time, I would kind of devour any books that I'd find that were different and interesting on the subject. Things like the Holographic Universe, if you've heard of that one by Michael Talbot. Some of the books by Paul Davies were great. Physics of Immortality by Frank Tipler. A variety of books like this that really kind of bend your mind a little bit and make you think about what the possibilities really are. So I've read a lot of those kinds of books and started maybe about 10 years ago reading a different kind of book, a kind of book that might have a little more to do with metaphysics than physics and what some may call even pseudoscience, although that's generally kind of a derogatory term. But, some other concepts, some things like paranormal occurrences and what they're all about and so forth. And, after having read all this, I actually started writing a book back in 2005 on relativity. And relativity was something that, again, I studied in school and kind of understood the concepts, understood how to solve problems, but there was always something about it that really bothered me. And I started to do a little research, and happened to be the same year that was the 100th anniversary of Einstein's special theory of relativity. So everybody and their brother were taking pot shots at poor Albert Einstein. And after a while, after doing a bit of this research, I kind of came up with something different. I was looking into quantum mechanics and just came to the realization that the way quantum mechanics describes our world, the way it describes the nature of reality, is really an awful lot like the way somebody might model a computer program or model a virtual reality in a computer. And I thought, boy, the similarities are really striking, and the book kind of took off from there.
Right. So if you will, give us a kind of, if it's doable, a general outline of what your theory is and how it goes, so to speak.
Sure. Now, I'll be the first to say that this is certainly not my theory. There have been a lot of science fiction writers in the past, Philip Dick and others, who have explored the ideas that maybe reality isn't as real as we think it is. Maybe, you know, not everybody who's walking around is as real as we think they are. And of course, in 1999 there was, you know, really kind of an interesting convergence of movies. The 13th Floor, The Matrix, and a movie called Existence all came out that year, and all had to do with the same idea that maybe our reality is a simulation of sorts. Nick Bostrom at Oxford University had written a white paper back in 2001, I believe, called The Simulation Argument. You're probably familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept has moved from sort of science fiction and pop culture into academia more recently, and people are starting to think about it in a little bit more with a little bit more credibility. I would say that my theory, if you can call it that, is that, you know, while I don't in any stretch of the imagination 100% believe that we have a programmed environment, I like to look at the evidence for it, and I think there's an awful lot of compelling evidence out there that implies that our world is programmed. So my book really is just a comprehensive collection of that evidence. We can read the book and determine whether or not it makes sense or not. You know, it's not proof. Nothing in science is proof. Math, you know, proof has to do with mathematics. Science has to do with evidence.
Right.
So I think that, you know, this is, again, something that, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence for, and I would, you know, welcome more thought on the concept, more types of evidence, or even, say, you know, falsifying experiments that can refute some of the evidence, because it's certainly an idea that is very interesting, and we would love to get to the bottom of and determine, you know, what is going on in our world.
Definitely. So I guess let's define the concept of program, or programmed. I guess there are different paths to take here right away, but lead us into it, if you will.
Sure. So by programmed reality, I mean that everything you perceive is under program control, or is generated by some computational mechanism. And that doesn't mean necessarily that the people that you interact with are robots. They can very easily be, avatars, effectively, or, you know, bodies under control of free will somewhere, much like in a MMORPG, massively multiplayer online role-playing game, World of Warcraft or EverQuest or something like that.
Right.
There's somebody behind those characters, and that certainly might be the case. But it's also very possible that a lot of what we see and interact with, the stuff that we interact with, is actually under program control, and that could be in the form of a simulated reality, a la The Matrix, or it could be in the form of the manifestation of a physical reality under program control. So both ways, I think, are possible.
And that would imply, obviously, that someone is behind the program and so forth, but let's wait on that little one. So what if we talk about the Matrix concept or idea a little bit? That is, as I understand it, primarily about manipulating, if you will, the senses of an entity or a live human being or whatever it might be behind there, meaning that you could actually be physically, you know, as it is in the Matrix, you're in a pod basically, and you're being you're experiencing a world that is through your senses only. Could you talk about that idea a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So that idea is an interesting one. I think that the important thing is to talk about, you know, whether or not it's really feasible. Now, I know that there are a lot of ways that people can escape from their reality. They can play video games or go to movies, and there's a concept in virtual reality called immersion, or level of immersion, which has to do with how immersed you are in that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some things that sort of alternative reality experiences where you're not that well immersed. So you go to a movie theater, you can get engrossed in the show. If something jumps out on the screen or makes a loud noise, you're going to jump out of your seat, perhaps. And the reason you do that is because you've gotten engrossed in the show and you're somewhat immersed in the experience. However, you know, it's easy to look around you and see that there's other people watching it. You have peripheral vision. You're not really getting all of the sensory experiences of what's going on the screen. You're sitting in a chair. So it's really kind of a partial immersion experience. And you can imagine how we can take steps toward a fuller immersion experience with things like virtual reality goggles that have high-resolution screens or some haptic devices, gloves, and things like that that
mm-hmm.
People have been experimenting with for 10 years at least.
Right.
So the concepts are there of creating simulations that we can experience. And the question is, at what point would we actually be able to kind of get into a scenario where we're in a reality that's kind of indistinguishable from what we think is true reality? And for that, you can start to look at Moore's Law. And Moore's Law, everybody's familiar with, is the idea that technology more or less doubles every 2 years.
Right.
And it really kind of depends on what you're talking about. For things like transistor density on a chip, it's every 2 years. Processor speed, turns out it's every 2.8 years. And screen resolutions is maybe every 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you kind of look at where we are in terms of computer gaming, it's an interesting place that we're in. So, for example, if you turn the clock back 25 years or so, there was a game called Pac-Man that used 64 pixel characters, and it was a 64 kilobit screen, ran on a 3 megahertz Z80 microprocessor. And if you remember that game, if you've ever played even the simulations of the game,
right.
There's no mistaking anything in that game for reality. You know, the little fruits that the Pac-Man went around and gobbled up did not look like real fruit. However, if you walk into an electronic superstore today and take a glance at a screen, you'll see a football or a soccer game on there, and you won't be able to tell necessarily the difference between whether it's a live game or whether it's a game like Madden NFL 08, some of these games that run on the consoles, PS3 and Wii and some of the other consoles. They are so realistic looking that it's hard to tell until you get up close and look a little bit closer.
Yeah.
And the reason for that, of course, is Moore's Law. They're running on a machine that's running 2 teraflops, a gigabyte of memory, 8 megabyte screens. So over 25 years, the resolution of screens has increased by 128. Processing speed's gone up by a factor of a million, and the resolution of the models of objects in these games has gone up by a factor of 1,000.
Right.
So given that, you ask the question, at what point will we get to the point when it will be indistinguishable from reality? Will it kind of hit the limitations of our perceptual resolution? And it turns out that perceptual resolution for vision is about 150 megabytes, and it's only going to take 16 more years, assuming that we maintain the Moore's Law doubling effect that we have been maintaining relentlessly for the past 40 years.
So Jim, that means that someone has actually kind of narrowed it down in regards to the human eye and what the brain can perceive in regards to gigabytes or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's 130 million receptors in your retina. There's about a million axons that carry that information through the optic nerve and then deeper into the brain and the visual cortex. They estimate that there's, 150 million or so cells. The 150 million megabytes that I came up with, I just, came up with by looking up the visual acuity of the human eye, at how you can determine angles and then basically extrapolating that into a large field and knowing how well we can discern colors and understanding how many bits it takes to discern that many colors, you come up with that kind of number. So it's really 16, 20 years or so where we can generate these kind of simulations. And now that's only part of the problem. That allows you to, again, generate a simulation. But how do you get that sort of injected into your senses?
Right.
And that's a different question. The idea of using screens and haptic devices is really kind of clumsy if you think about it. I can't imagine that anybody's going to be fooled into thinking they're in a different reality because they're wearing goggles. You might not realize it for a while, but you know you can still tell the difference.
Exactly, and I guess also it depends a little bit on how we would get immersed in the simulation, so to speak. If it is all that we have ever known, it would obviously be more difficult to determine that we're in one, right?
Exactly. Now there's some really interesting things going on in the world of nanotechnology that directly relate to your question. So, for example, a couple of years ago, there were some teams, or some research teams at MIT and Caltech that were able to take monkeys. They had electrodes in their brains, and they showed these monkeys various images. And just by reading the signals emanating from their brains, they were able to tell to an accuracy of 80% what image the monkeys were looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So what that tells you is that even though this is sort of a very nascent technology, something that we're just beginning to explore, it does show that it's possible to read brainwave patterns and determine what your sensory stimuli are.
Mm-hmm.
In the other direction, there's been a lot done with artificial vision, retinal implants, and things like that. And some devices have been made that have a small number of pixels, 60 pixels, I think, is what they're up to now. But they can feed signals from little cameras mounted on a goggle device into an implant in your retina, and blind people can actually start to see patterns, grids of light.
Right.
It's very rudimentary at this point, but it shows that we're able to feed sensory information directly into the brain because the optic nerve really is an extension of the brain. There are other experiments that are being done that go further back into the brain, into an area, I forget what it's called, escapes me at the moment, LGN, lateral geniculate nucleus, and I don't know if I even pronounced that right.
But, right.
It's a part of the brain that relays the signals from the optic nerve to the visual cortex. And they're finding that they can stimulate that area and generate, patterns of light that are perceived by the subject. So we're getting, we're at the beginning of these technologies, and I think that, again, you can apply Moore's Law, and you can apply, in fact, Moore's Law, the pace of technology is even faster at the beginning of technology. So, for example, it took 16 years to develop that 16-pixel version of the retinal implant. It only took 4 years to develop a 60-pixel one because we're on a very steep part of that curve. So, what all this says is that it's very likely at some point that there will be either retinal implants or implants deeper into your brain that can intercept your sensory signals and process them, perhaps. So, imagine if it's a device, it could be something kind of kludgy like an implant, but it could also be nanobots. I mean, you're probably familiar with that concept as well. It could be, devices that, nanoscopic devices that you've snorted up or something. they've gotten into your neural complex, and they can be intercepting the signals and networked together. They can pass those signals to potentially a central computer, and that computer could say, "Oh, well, this person now is looking in the mirror. So instead of sending them the imagery that makes them realize they're looking at themselves, I'm going to send them the imagery of a chimpanzee, and as you're looking in the mirror, you think you're looking at a chimpanzee. You raise your hand to your face to feel your smooth face, and the nanobots transfer that information back to the host computer, which has the ability to determine what you're trying to do, and says, well, he's trying to feel his face now, so what we're going to do is make that sense feel more like monkey hair. And so all of your senses theoretically could be completely fooled into thinking that you're a chimpanzee.
Right, right. And obviously this opens up some very scary doors, so to speak.
Absolutely.
I mean, one question is, of course, how do we know that this already hasn't occurred? I mean, what we have been talking about so far is kind of what we are, you know, currently developing, what we see in the years ahead coming, and because of that we can do that now, we can kind of potentially perceive that what if the case might be that actually a civilization either previous to ours, or, you know, that we actually are somewhere else, or whatnot, but let's say that they themselves actually developed a simulation, if you will, a world to enter into, and that we simply are born into it right now. I mean, how can we know that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And if you think about it, you realize that we really can't know. For example, the technologies that we were just discussing, those same technologies could be used to erase memories.
Right.
They're making a lot of headway these days into understanding how we remember things. It has to do with, you know, the release of glutamates, of chemicals at the synapse level that reinforce the strength of those synapses. Well, you know, theoretically, nanobots could do that. Nanobots could destroy certain synapses, or they could build them up.
I mean, that's actually around today. If you think about it, monosodium glutamate is one of those, and that's actually only a chemical. So imagine what you can do with a, you know, nanobot going in there, you know?
Absolutely, yeah, sure. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if this technology is possible, then it's certainly feasible to say that, you know, you could imagine a situation where your memory could be temporarily erased. You could be presented with a reality that's different than the one that you knew before. And you could even, you know, if this were sort of a friendly scenario, you could say, let me experience that reality for an hour or a couple hours and then restore my memory to what it was prior to that. And, you know, I can, and although there are a lot of futurists you know, people like Ray Kurzweil who believe in the possibility of uploading and downloading memory banks at some point in the future, and not that far into the future either. So all this seems to be, you know, 20, 30 years out there. And like you said, how do we know that it's not already going on? And
right.
I think that's really the core of the argument that Nick Bostrom talks about with his simulation argument.
Tell us about that a little bit then.
Sure, and that's that. You know, to me, that's just a very interesting kind of logical argument. And basically, it goes like this: we've talked about the possibility that we'll get to that point, to the point where we can create simulations that are indistinguishable from reality. He refers to that as post-humanism, and
right.
refers to the simulations as ancestor simulations. So he identifies three possibilities. One, we will destroy ourselves before we get there, and that's certainly a pessimistic point of view. Two, we will not get to that point because we'll consciously decide not to pursue that avenue of inquiry.
Right.
And I don't know about you, Henrik, but I kind of feel like you can throw out that option. Like, when have we ever been faced with a technology that was interesting to pursue and not pursued it to the hilt?
Exactly. Yeah, I think you're right there.
So then the third option is that we do get to that point, but when we get to that point, we will generate millions of these ancestor simulations, excuse me, and therefore, if there are millions of ancestor simulations generated, the odds that we're living in one of those millions of ancestor simulations is far greater than the odds that we happen to be living in the one 30 years prior to it and just thinking about it. So in his argument, the optimistic point of view is that we're almost certainly living in a simulation. The pessimistic point of view is that we will destroy ourselves. So that's kind of kind of an interesting, certainly an interesting argument to think about.
Oh yeah, definitely. So I mean, are there any kind of, let's say like this, if we are in a simulation right now, are there, you know, hints, so to speak, lying around that we are in a simulation? Are there Easter eggs in the program, so to speak?
Yeah, I think there are, and we can probably spend the whole rest of the program talking about those, and I'm sure we've all experienced, things that just seemed inexplicable. I had an experience when I was in high school where I got up one day and just walked across the room, picked up the telephone, and said, "Hello, Bill." And my friend Bill was on the other end of the line, and the phone had never rung. And what prompted me to do that, I have no idea what it was. I only did that one time in my life, and it wasn't like I heard, you know, just the tail end of a ring, because the time it took for me to walk across the room was longer than it takes between rings of a telephone in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So it was impossible that, you know, that I had heard something. And he was stunned because the call had just gone through, it hadn't rung yet, and here I am just, you know, saying his name. So I actually calculated the odds that something like that would happen, and it's in the billions to one. So, you know, things like that seem to be Easter eggs. They seem to be, evidence or examples of there's something behind all of this. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's programmed.
Right.
There is some evidence on the programming side as well, and be glad to get into that whenever you're ready.
Yeah. I mean, because what you described there is kind of what people would perceive at the first level, at least, as kind of a psychic ability, basically, and that.
Right.
But I mean, that also opens up a very interesting door in that sense that things that we have, you know, perceived as magic, other paranormal abilities or whatnot could possibly be either, you know, a glitch in the matrix, so to speak, or that we actually potentially at some times access other, levels of the programming. Or what would you say that it is?
Well, exactly. I mean, you touched on a couple things there. That are right on, I think. One of the things that I've thought about is, are you familiar with World of Warcraft, the role-playing game?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, when people play that, I have some friends who have guilds, and what they do is they talk to each other, they put headsets on, and they talk to each other through another mechanism, not through the program, but through what you might refer to as an out-of-band mechanism. It's another, you know, might be IP-based.
Like Skype or something like that.
Skype, yeah, something like that.
Right.
So what they're doing there is they're having some sort of out-of-band communication. Well, to people who might not be aware of that, who are also playing the game, they would be sort of astonished at the way the certain characters seem to know what each other is doing. Now, they're doing that because it's an intentional thing, but I could also imagine that there might be some sort of unintentional mechanisms where you get hints of things that are going on that can be done programmatically. It's a little hard to explain, but you could certainly imagine a program that maybe whispers in your ear or gives you some sort of subliminal indication of something that you can't quite put your finger on, but that could explain certain paranormal events.
Mm. Very interesting.
You also mentioned the idea of the sorry to interrupt there. But
no problem.
The idea of the parallel realities. There is, you know, a perfect analog for that in the gaming world as well. A lot of these games will run on a particular server, and you're in your environment on your server, there's a whole different set of people playing the game on a different server with the same construct, the same scenery, and the same, you know, ogres and monsters and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, there's no reason why you couldn't effectively teleport to a different server. Programmatically, it's not hard to do, to copy somebody's, all the data that describes their character and the state of their character could be just, you know, moved right over to a different server. And if you were unaware that there was any other reality, you'd be pretty shocked at that. You'd be surprised that, oh my gosh, you know, all of a sudden I'm surrounded by different people.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you hear people describe scenarios like that, and maybe this is the kind of thing that happens.
Very interesting. Almost like, again, I guess that all the possibilities, so to speak, opens up if this were in fact a simulation that we are a part of, in regards to that. We are obviously confined to certain types of laws as it is now. If we again talk a little bit about the Matrix, the idea there is that because of his ability to transcend some of the laws that are put upon the character, so to speak, he can do certain things that the other ones can't do. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. Imagine the concept of a UFO. A lot of people have seen UFOs. I've never seen one, but I don't discount the fact that other people have seen them.
Right.
So, you know, what could account for that? You know, one possibility is that it's part of a program. You could imagine if you were playing a video game, for example, the game itself could generate things that violated the laws of physics that the rest of the players were subject to.
Yeah.
And so when we see objects that move around the sky and seem to make, you know, turns that would, you know, violate what we know about aerodynamics or whatever, it could be a programmatic thing. It could be something that's generated programmatically. The perfect explanation for it. In fact, I think one of the problems with this idea is that it makes everything so possible, it's kind of hard to falsify.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, that would imply potentially then that there could be someone with access to the code, or how, you know, people that know how to manipulate reality, almost like, you know, sorcerers of this world, and they would have obviously certain abilities that the rest of us wouldn't have.
Exactly. Think about how in games, let's say somebody discovers a way to kind of hack the game. Maybe they found out how to steal money, or how to increase the money that they have by a factor of 10 just through some hack. Well, the programmers of that game are going to have to fix that. They'll have to apply a patch, and the patch will go in unbeknownst to all the players, because you can put hot patches into these games.
Mm.
And the same thing could happen in our reality. We could, you know, we could be moving along at a certain point and discover nuclear energy and, you know, potentially destroy ourselves, and maybe the programmers put in some fail-safe mechanisms to keep that from happening.
Mm.
You can certainly imagine all kinds of possibilities that follow that patch-like model, but it does sort of imply that that the quote gods or whoever, you know, might be running the reality is an active participant in it, and they're watching over things, perhaps.
That was very interesting. I mean, let's say then that this is being run by a very powerful server, so to speak, potentially some kind of, you know, quantum computer or something like that. I mean, the questions that arise is, of course, okay, it's, as you say, someone watching over the server, maintaining it, or is this actually, you know, out there? This, if you think about it, this potentially could actually be some kind of Noah's Ark. I've heard this theory before, by the way, but it's kind of a Noah's Ark experiment, where a lot of people have uploaded their consciousness into a machine that actually has been, I don't know, you know, sent into space, or is, you know, standing on some other planet because of the conditions on our planet were, you know, getting so hostile, or the planet was dying, or I don't know what. You can put in whatever you want there, but this would imply, you know, that someone could find the server, destroy it, right? You know, have you thought about stuff like that?
Sure, yeah. No, and you touch upon, a really interesting aspect of this, which is motivation. What would be the motivation behind all of this? And you know, boy, that's another thing that we could spend a lot of time talking about. But, you know, you provide a really good scenario. The Noah's Ark scenario is one very, palatable motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the reliability of the hardware, if you will, I think that that's something to sort of not worry about. And the reason I say that, I actually had somebody who heard me on another show sent an email to me and asked me that the same question. Having worked in the past in the high availability server industry, I know that today we can generate servers with uptimes of, I think it's 0.9999996 nines, and we can also build systems that have triple redundancy and voting logic, which means that you have three servers that are running the same software, and they're all monitoring each other. And if at any point two of them determine that one of them is out of step, they raise an alarm and kick it out effectively.
Mm.
So if you use that kind of redundancy with the high availability mechanisms of servers, it turns out that we would have a mean time between failure of millions of years with today's technology.
Mm. But that still implies that, power is available, someone is there, looking over things, I'm talking about, I guess, a little bit about the scenario that this is standing there by itself and running, so to speak, and everyone has, uploaded themselves into it, I don't know, is that possible, you think?
I think it's certainly a possibility. I think it would be very interesting to get into also some of the evidence for the actual programmed model, as opposed to, some of the evidence that there's something else out there that we've been talking about too.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about the quantum mechanics aspect of this, which
definitely
I find that one to be, really very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
For any listeners who might not be that familiar with quantum mechanics, one of the kind of fundamental concepts of it is that everything that we perceive is quantized. It's in little packets. Light is packets of energy, and matter is packets. And even space itself is quantized at some point. And so most quantum physicists think that, when you look around a room, you see things, and it's easy to tell that there's sort of a continuity of matter, of stuff, and of space between those things. If you were looking through a microscope, you would see there's a continuity there. And as deep as we can look we can now see actual molecules with scanning microscopes. But even at that point, all we see is, a continuity of things. Well, when you get down to 10 to the minus 36 meters, you hit what's called the Planck length, which theoretically is the limit of resolution of space.
Mm.
And that basically says that at that point, you can't even define anything between two Planck lengths. It's either there or it's at the next one. There's nothing in between.
Okay. Mm.
Well, what works that way? Everything in a computer program works the same way. The screen that you're looking at looks fairly continuous until you look at it close up and you see the actual pixels and the red, blue, and green dots.
Mm.
The models of things in virtual reality programs or in gaming have to have some limit. You model a tree, maybe you allocate 50 kilobytes for a model of a tree or 100 or something like that, but you can't give it an infinite resolution because infinite resolution would require infinite memory and infinite disk, and it would be infinitely expensive.
Mm.
So you have to have a limitation on the resolution of things. Now, let's say you have a tree that's modeled to a pretty high-level resolution. As you look at it, you can't tell that it's digitized in any way until you get very, very close. A lot of gaming companies now are applying dynamic resolution adjustments, so the closer you get, You know, it brings in different models that will then model what that bark of the tree looks like close up. You cut into the tree. You know, prior to anybody cutting into the tree, you didn't need to model the inside of the tree. As soon as you cut into a tree, now you have to model the inside of it, and you have to model it to the level of instrumentation that your players would have to analyze it. But you don't have to model everything to that level. You only have to model the trees that they cut into, and you only have to model the ones that, you know, that they're the cells that they're investigating, for example. So this all kind of, you know, you see this huge analogy between quantum mechanics in the spatial dimensions and the modeling of objects in a computer program. And in the time dimension, it's the same way. According to quantum mechanics, time is quantized as well at the level of 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. There's a physicist named Julian Barber who wrote a book called The End of Time, where he takes that idea to its sort of logical conclusion and says that basically our universe is just a sequence of states. It's a state of information that's clocked every 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. You know, there's nothing in between those two clock cycles. They are referred to by physicists as a jiffy. So between one jiffy and another jiffy, nothing happens in our universe.
Nothing changes or nothing moves.
Nothing changes. So, well, so a computer works the same way.
Right.
The clocking of a CPU happens when the CPU clocks. Bits get pushed into memory, into registers, arithmetic logic operations are performed, disk reads, things like that. But in between the clock cycles, absolutely nothing happens. So it's just a big state machine. And quantum mechanics kind of implies that our reality is just a big state machine, too. So the similarities are really striking. It's very tempting to say, oh, well, that's ridiculous. You know, we'll never get to the point of modeling a reality to the Planck length and the Planck time, you know, because it was just, it's so far beyond things. And obviously, you know, we can't push atoms around. Atoms are 20 orders of magnitude larger than the Planck length or something like that. So, but that, you know, a lot of assumptions are in those kinds of ways of thinking. One assumption is that quarks or strings even are the ultimate building blocks of matter. Well, nothing's ever been found to be the ultimate building block of matter. I can almost guarantee you that when the Linear Hadron Collider goes online and people start, you know, exploring things, they're going to, you know, dig deeper into the nature of reality. When people discover evidence for strings, they're going to realize that strings are made from something, if indeed strings exist. So I guess what I'm saying is that Moore's law can just keep on moving along even at these other realms. You know, in nanotech we're playing with chemical bonds. Maybe sometime in the future we'll be moving around nuclear bonds, atomic not bonds, bonds.
Right.
moving them around as well. And if you, you know, if you take the Planck length or the Moore's law concept out to the quantum mechanical level, it'll only take a couple hundred years to get to that point. I think I calculated it out to 2192 or something like that. But there's a big there's a big assumption there, and that is that you have to model reality to see these quantum mechanical effects. That's not necessarily true. The quantum mechanical effects could be modeled by a program, and the resolution of the model could be much higher than that level.
Right.
That's also perfectly possible.
And I mean, if we're talking about a program in that sense, that would, I mean, let's say you do an experiment, so to speak. You put something into a box, and then or let's take a 3D program or a computer program. You take objects and put them into the program, a controlled environment, so to speak, and then you apply certain laws to it, like we have, you know, obviously gravity, things like this, of this nature. and then things will begin to happen by themselves and adjust themselves accordingly to those laws. Much the same way, I guess, we could look at reality today, that what we see, you know, and what is going on is you know, either basically just an extension of you know, if we want to go that way, the Big Bang or whatever, that things are just rearranging themselves according to the different laws, and that might be the initial boot up or starting of the program is the Big Bang, if you will, and now it just, you know, sustains itself, so to speak. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. It's sort of winding up the clock and letting the universe just run.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that, yeah?
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, do you think that if we talk about the manipulation or the programming on the molecular level, that this is what might actually be going on then, that in a sense, our universe is a machine in that sense, or a program. But the only question that arises is it, I guess, a philosophical one, meaning is it God who started the program, or is it you know, a nerdy teenager who's running a program somewhere? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, and there it's, I don't know, you know, this is probably sort of the next thing that I think would be very interesting to think about in a lot more detail. I mean, I've thought a lot about the evidence, but not really so much about, you know, kind of making some logical conclusions about who's behind it and why.
Right.
That, you know, you can certainly speculate, but it would be really interesting to dream up some experiments that might lend support to one idea or another, or make kind of narrow down the field of, you know, who the gods are, who the programmers are.
Right.
I think that'd be really interesting, and I don't know if anybody's done that yet.
Yes, future products.
Yeah. I know there is one kind of interesting trend in cosmology, which is Flexi laws. Are you familiar with those?
No, I'm not. No.
It's an idea that in quantum mechanics there's the observer effect. There's the idea that something doesn't really happen until it's observed. And what Flexi laws are, it's a concept that the laws of physics themselves evolve sort of in a non-causal way. In other words, we're in the reality that we're in now, and the laws of physics had to have evolved, you know, working backwards to the Big Bang. It's a very interesting concept, and it's kind of like saying that you know, the existence of the observers in the universe that we have now have to bring about the conditions by sort of reaching back into the past through this quantum observation. That was Stephen Hawking and John Wheeler have done a lot of thinking about that.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm familiar with the idea that you know, on if we talk about quantum mechanics, I guess, or quantum physics, that you know, it is only when you put in an observer of the, you know, environment, so to speak, that things are happening or taking shape, and even that the consciousness of the observer actually influences the particles, you know.
Exactly. Now, with that idea in mind, think about the possibility that you're again in a game, and there's a room, and nobody has ever been in that room. So you don't know what's inside the room. It's impossible to tell what's inside the room. In fact, the programmers may have put absolutely nothing in the room. Now somebody finds a key or finds a way to break the door down. Somehow there has to be something in the room. So when they go into the room is when what's in the room gets discovered, and it's when it becomes real. It's sort of another, you know, analogous way of looking at the observer effect in quantum mechanics.
Very interesting. Hey, you know what? We're beginning to come to the end of our time here in the first segment, but we'd love to continue talking with you. There's much more that I want to explore, like, for instance, the singularity, dive into a little bit more of the AI aspect to all of this. Excuse me. And then also of course, to talk a little bit about the Second Life thing going up right now, ongoing, so to speak. Sweden actually opened up an embassy in Second Life, by the way, but there's much more to discuss here in the next segment. So do you have the time for us to continue?
Sure, absolutely.
Excellent. I want to leave the last few minutes here to you, though, so you can tell people about your website and also how they can get a copy of your book for those who are interested.
Okay, sure. The website, as Henrik mentioned, was theuniversesolved.com. The book, for people outside of the U.S., which may be a large part of this audience, it's probably best to order the book on Amazon. They deal with all the international shipping arrangements. So you can just go to Amazon and type in my name or The Universe Solved, and you'll find the book. I don't have a distribution arrangement in Europe at this time, so they would have to get ordered from the U.S., so shipping is a little bit more expensive that way, but there is always that possibility. The website, went up, ostensibly to, kind of pique interest in the idea and to help sell the book as well. But I'm trying to make it as interactive as I can, and I've been putting some things on there that, that make it a little bit more interactive and interesting. So, for example, there's a chatterbot, which is I've named Morpheus in honor of Morpheus from The Matrix, and this is basically an AI that is run out of a group, AI-I.com, which I think they're based in Israel, and he's actually very interesting. He's armed with a number of jokes, and he can actually learn as you tell him things, and he'll kind of repeat back some of the stuff. And I'm actually surprised at the level of conversation that he's gotten to at this point. When I first put him up, he kind of had ADHD, but now he's getting a little bit better at maintaining a conversation.
Right, right.
There's also a Powers of 10 application on there. Powers of 10, people are probably familiar with the idea where you start from a intergalactic space and you keep on getting 10 times closer to the Earth, and then you dive 10 times closer into atoms and things like that. Well, I put one up that shows sort of what we think of in terms of the limits of quantum mechanics and the limits of cosmology, but you can also jump to parallel realities. So you can explore the programmed reality model and how that might be different, and you can explore some other parallel realities. So that's interactive. And I'm working on trying to get a forum up there as well so that people can post their own ideas and comment on others. But that's probably coming in the next month or so.
The website, again, is theuniversesolved.com. Jim and I are going to take a break right here, but we'll continue our discussion in our members section. We're going to talk more about the singularity, nanotechnology regulation, Second Life, quantum physics, consciousness, the soul, and what it means if we indeed do live in a simulation. So head on over to our website, redicecreations.com, to find out how to sign up and tune in to the continuation of our program with Jim Elvidge. Thank you for listening, and my thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. This is Henrik Palmgren. We'll talk more at the other side of the break.